pushed open the door into the pub. Several men were standing around the bar with beers in their hands, and they looked up as Ben came in.
"Evening, Mr. Cresswell," the bartender said. "Good to see you home again."
Ben went up to the bar and ordered a pint.
"You here for long, then?" one of the men asked. "Or just pop down to see your old dad?"
"I had a few days' leave coming," Ben said. "It's nice to get out of London for a break."
"Seen much bombing, then?"
one of the men asked.
"We've had our share," Ben said. "But you get used to it. Nobody even looks up at work now when the air raid sirens go off."
"What sort of job are you doing, then?"
another asked.
"Working for one of the ministries," he said.
"Doing what?"
Ben grinned.
"You know we're not allowed to discuss our work."
"Not allowed to discuss it?"
a voice behind them said, and Ben turned to see a skinny chap with bright red hair coming toward them. Billy Baxter, the builder's son. Ben felt his hand clench into a fist. Billy had always enjoyed tormenting him when they were small boys, and he was grinning.
"Hush-hush work, is it then, Ben?"
"He said he can't discuss it," one of the older men said.
Ben turned his gaze to the redhead.
"I notice you're not in uniform either, Billy Baxter," he said.
"Ah, well, I'm in a protected occupation, aren't I?" Billy said.
"Making bow windows for Britain?"
Ben asked and was pleased to get a general laugh. Billy Baxter flushed.
"If your roof gets blown in during the next bombing raid, who do you think will come out and patch it before the rain gets in?"
"You seem to be doing quite well out of it," Ben said. "I noticed that new bungalow your dad has built. Looks quite fancy."
"Hard work pays off, doesn't it?" Billy said.
Ben watched Billy Baxter as he ordered a pint. He was the type who would sell his own grandmother if the price was right. But working for the Germans, Ben didn't think he'd have the temperament. At heart, he was a coward, as proved that time Ben had punched him and made his nose bleed and he'd run home crying. Ben's father had lectured him on violence and restraint, but actually he had looked quite pleased. Halfway through his pint, the pub door burst open and a group of soldiers came in, talking and laughing loudly. They barged their way up to the bar, and Ben noticed that the local men moved away. There was tension in the air. Then one of the soldiers said,
"What are you drinking, miss?"
And Ben noticed Lady Diana was with them. She was dressed in red trousers, and her hair was tied back in a red bandana like a land girl's, and she was wearing bright red lipstick.
"Don't call her miss. It's my lady. She's the daughter of an earl,"
one of the soldiers hissed at his friend. Dido heard and laughed.
"Oh, for goodness sake, call me Diana or Dido. I can't stand stuffiness."
"I'll have half a pint of shandy, please, Ronnie."
As she looked around the room, she spotted Ben at the same time and gave him a big smile.
"Hello, Ben," she said. "These nice boys offered to take me with them to the pub. Wasn't that kind of them? A brief escape from captivity, you know."
She laughed, but her eyes were saying, "Don't tell anyone you've seen me here." The bartender looked uncomfortable.
"Pardon me, my lady, but this is the public bar. Don't you think you'd be more comfortable in the private bar next door? There are armchairs, and it's not quite as rowdy there."
"Nonsense," Dido said, giving Ben a swift glance for support. "I spend my life banished away from people. I want to live a little. I want to hear laughter and talk to ordinary people."
She looked back to the soldier who had offered her a drink.
"Make that a pint, Ronnie," she said.
She walked over to Ben as the pint was being drawn.
"So what are you doing these days, Dido?" Ben asked her. "Still at home?"
She gave a dramatic sigh.
"Still stuck at home? Pa won't let me do anything useful. I'm dying to do my part, you know. I don't suppose you could find me a job in London, could you? At the place where you work?"
I probably could, but I can't go against your father's wishes while you're still a minor. There might be useful things to be done in Sevenoaks or Tunbridge.
Being a land girl and helping raise pigs, that's about it. I want to do something exciting. I'm going to ask Mr. Churchill next time we see him. Pa knows him quite well, you know. And if Mr. Churchill says he wants to employ me, then Pa certainly can't say no, can he?
Do you have any useful skills? Ben asked. Can you type and take shorthand?
Not really.
She chewed on her lip, making him realize how young she still was. That's the sort of thing that women are hired to do on the whole, he said. Office work. Clerical stuff.
Boring, boring, boring. I'd rather drive an ambulance, or learn to be a radio operator, or even join the army.
They don't let women fight. I imagine you'd still be doing clerical tasks in uniform.
It's not fair, she pouted. I'm just as capable as these boys, and just as brave.
Oh, no, miss, one of the soldiers said. It was to protect ladies like you that we joined up. We have to believe that you'll be safe at home, waiting for us when we're shipped overseas. Will you be going overseas soon? Ben asked. The young soldier frowned. We haven't heard anything. Our lot was at Dunkirk. We lost men there, but I suppose it will be our turn to ship out again soon enough. In the meantime, life in Kent isn't too bad, especially when there are young ladies like you around. And he grinned at Dido. Ben had just decided there was no point in staying on any longer at the pub when Dr. Sinclair came in, and beside him a middle-aged man. There was something distinctly foreign in his facial features and the cut of his jacket. The mysterious German, Ben thought, and went over to greet them. The doctor greeted Ben warmly and introduced his companion.
"This is Dr. Rosenberg. He's helping me with my practice. Splendid chap."
The other man gave a correct little bow and held out his hand.
"How do you do?" he said in clipped English.
"You're from Germany?" Ben asked pleasantly.
"Austria," Dr. Rosenberg said. "I was at the medical school at the University of Vienna before the war." "One of their most distinguished professors," Dr. Sinclair added. "He managed to get out just in time."
The man looked at Ben with a bleak expression.
"It never occurred to me that I was not safe, even though my grandfather was Jewish. I mean, I don't look Jewish, do I? And I was a respected man. Then the Germans marched in, and I was dismissed from my position and told I had to wear a yellow star. That was enough for me. I left everything and took the next train to Italy, and then to France, and then here."
He paused to take the glass of beer that the doctor offered him.
"I was fortunate to get out in time. I hear that my friends and relatives were not so lucky. They made my fellow professors scrub the streets while people spat on them, and others just disappeared. Nobody knew where they went, but there were rumors of camps."
He shook his head.
"Sometimes I feel guilty that I am here, in this pleasant place, able to practice my medicine." "You made the right decision, old chap," Dr. Sinclair said. "You acted. Others didn't. Most people don't think such things can happen to them until too late."
Ben left the Three Bells, thinking about Dr. Rosenberg. As he had said, he didn't look Jewish, with his blonde hair and light greenish eyes. Ben toyed with the idea that he could have been a plant, sent over to become embedded in the community. Dr. Sinclair was a soft-hearted man, lonely, easily taken in. Perhaps the parachutist had expected to find sanctuary at the doctor's house.
Chapter 18. Farley again. The next morning there was a great excitement in several households with the arrival of the morning post.
Lady Esme looked up in surprise, waving a sheet of paper at the other occupants of the breakfast table.
"Well, isn't that nice?" she said. "We're invited to a dinner party at the Prescotts to celebrate Jeremy's safe return home."
"Just you and Pa or all of us?" Dido asked.
"It says you and your family," Lady Esme said. "Not Phoebe, of course. She's too young for dinner parties."
"What?"
Phoebe looked up from her porridge.
"That's not fair. I'm never included in anything."
"You are not an adult, Phoebe. You haven't come out," Lady Esme said.
"Neither has Dido. Neither has anybody these days," Phoebe said.
"Don't remind me,"
Dido said angrily.
"If you're talking about not fair, then my missing a season is the unfairest of all. No balls, no parties, nothing. I'll never meet a man, and I'll die an old spinster."
"I don't know how they can get their hands on enough food to hold a dinner party when we are eating sawdust sausages and shepherd's pie that is 90% potato,"
Lord Westrum interrupted this tirade.
"But then that blighter Prescott always does seem to get his hands on things other people can't. He drives that Rolls of his around as if there wasn't petrol rationing."
"He's on important committees, dear," Lady Esme said. "Obviously, he has to go up to London."
"What's wrong with a train like for the rest of us?" Lord Westrum snapped. "I am most careful about the amount of petrol I use."
"I don't believe you've taken out the motor car once since the chauffeur was called up," Lady Esme said. "But then you've always been a hopeless driver."
"I resent that," Lord Westrum retorted. "I'm sure I could be a splendid driver if I put my mind to it, but there's always been a chauffeur, so there didn't seem much point. Besides, we are supposed to set a good example by not using any unnecessary petrol. And since I'm apparently no use to anybody in the war effort, apart from leading the local home guard, I have no justification to use petrol."
"If you teach me to drive, I could chauffeur us around," Dido said. "Will you, Pa?"
"You? Drive us around? Even without the petrol coupons, the answer to that would be no, no, 1,000 times no. You'd be more danger to the British populace than the Germans. You'd kill us all."
"I wouldn't," Dido said, her cheeks now bright pink. "I bet I'd be a marvellous driver. Lots of girls from good families are driving ambulances and lorries these days, doing their bit for the war effort, unlike me, stuck here, bored to tears."
"Anyway, Roddy, you'll have to get the motor car out to drive us to the Prescotts," Lady Esme said. "We can hardly arrive on bicycles."
"I don't know if I want to go," Lord Westrum said. "There's something about that blighter Prescott. I don't trust him. He's not one of us."
"How can you say that, Pa?"
Pamma had sat quietly until now, finishing up a slice of toast and marmalade.
"Because he's not. Oh, he might have a fine house and all the airs and graces these days, but he grew up distinctly middle class."
"Well, he's one of us now," Pamma said. "He has a title, just like you."
"You either inherit a title or you buy it," Lord Westrum said dryly. "In his case, the latter. And I query how he made all that money, too. There is something too smooth about the blighter."
"You're just jealous, Pa," Dido said with a little grin. "So will you teach me to drive? I could drive us over to the Prescotts tomorrow. I can hardly hit anyone going down our driveway, can I?"
"Absolutely bloody well not," Lord Westrum stormed.
"Then what can I do?"
"Stay at home and help your mother until you're old enough. That's what you can do. Knit socks and helmets for soldiers."
"Knit things? You're joking. If I were a son and I was 18, I bet you'd be proud if I joined up."
A spasm of pain crossed his face.
"But you're not, are you? I just have girls, and it's my job to protect them."
If you're not careful, I'll run off and marry a gypsy, and then you'll be sorry.
Dido stood up, dropped her napkin, and flounced out of the room.
I'll look forward to buying clothes pegs from you,
Lord Westrum called after her, chuckling. Lady Esme looked at her husband.
You'll have to let go of her sometime, Roddy. I understand how she feels. She can't sit home doing nothing when everyone else is helping with the war effort.
When she's 21, she can do as she bloody well pleases, he said. Until then, she's under my care, and I do what I think is best for her. You know what she's like, Esme. If we let her go off to London, she'll be back with an illegitimate baby in 10 minutes.
Really, Roddy? Sometimes you go too far.
Lady Esme turned pink. I must make sure we all have something decent to wear to the Prescotts. I haven't had my good frocks out for ages, and Lady Prescott is always so chic. She looked across at Pamela, who had now risen from the table.
Did you bring an evening dress with you, darling? I left most of my things here, she said. Not much chance to wear evening dresses when I'm on night shift. Then pass the news on to Livy, will you? I'm sure she'll want to come.
As Pamela left the room, she heard her father say,
I've been thinking this over, Esme, and the more I think of it, the less I want to go. Prescott will be effusive and magnanimous, and handing out his single malt scotch and getting my goat.
But we have to go, Lady Esme lowered her voice, for your daughter's sake.
Pamela paused in the passage outside the dining room.
Daughter? Which daughter?
Pamela, of course. It's to celebrate Jeremy's safe return. Jeremy and Pamela, you know?
No, I don't know. Has he asked for her hand or something?
No, but I'm sure he will when the time is right.
Pamela waited no longer but went on up the stairs. Her face was flushed at what she had just heard. Everyone else assumed she'd marry Jeremy, except Jeremy himself, it seemed. And now another nagging doubt had crept into her mind. Her sister Dido. She had apparently been visiting Jeremy, and then last night... Dido was waiting at the top of the stairs.
Are you sure I can't come and live with you, Pamma? I'll go mad if I stay here much longer. They must be able to find me a job where you work. I'd take anything at this stage, even boring old filing.
Dido, you can't go against Pa's wishes, you know that. Besides, I share a room with another girl in an absolutely awful boarding house, and we're as far out of London as we are here, stuck in the middle of the countryside with nothing going on. You'd be just as bored as you are here.
But you must be working with men.
That's true, although I wouldn't call most of them exciting either. They're too old, or they're gangly boys with pimples. Nothing exciting, I assure you. She turned to her sister.
I know. Why don't you ask Pa to see if the Colonel of the West Kents could use you for office duties?
That would be a start and get you some experience. Dido's face brightened.
Yes, that would be a start, wouldn't it? Good thinking, Pamma. You're not such a bad old stick.
As she went to walk past, Pamela said in a low voice,
I know you were out last night, Dido. I heard the floorboards creaking and saw you going into your room. Where did you go?
A worrying thought had been playing in her mind that Dido had been to see Jeremy, and Dido didn't seem to have any inhibitions about sex, positively keen for it, in fact. Had she been giving Jeremy what Pamela had denied him? Dido grinned.
To the Three Bells with some of the soldiers I met.
Pamela heard herself give a sigh of relief.
Dido, for heaven's sake, be careful. Pa would hit the roof if he found out. And soldiers, that's not exactly wise. It was brilliant. They were so nice to me. They treated me perfectly.
Well, I suppose they would, given that you're the daughter of the house where they're staying, and you're a lady.
But it wasn't like that at all. We talked, we laughed. It was so nice to be just like an ordinary person, one of the gang. Is that what it's like where you work? Do they have to call you my lady and rubbish like that? Pamela laughed now. Of course not. And they certainly don't treat me any differently because I'm the daughter of an earl. That's what I want, to be someplace where nobody cares who I am. Pamela put a hand tentatively on her sister's arm. Your turn will come, I promise you. And if this war goes on much longer, then I'm afraid we'll all be called upon to do our share. Golly, I hope so, Dido said. Thanks, Pamma. And you won't say anything to Pa, will you? I won't. But you'll be lucky if someone from the village doesn't blab. You know what gossips they all are. You really are a good old stick, Dido repeated. Thank you for the compliment. Pamma smiled as she went into her bedroom. Phoebe stomped into her room, making her governess look up from the book she was reading. "Why, Phoebe, whatever's the matter?" she asked. "They've all been invited to a dinner party at the Prescotts, and I'm not included." "Well, I wouldn't feel too badly about it," Miss Gumble said with a smile at the girl's scowling face. "I'm not invited either." "Well, of course you wouldn't be. You're only a governess," Phoebe said, and saw a spasm of pain cross the woman's face. "For your information, Phoebe Sutton, I grew up in a situation not unlike yours. Oh, our house wasn't quite as grand as this one, and my father didn't have a title, but it was a good-sized estate. Then my father died when I was up at Oxford, and my brother inherited everything. And his wife told me in no uncertain terms that I was no longer welcome at my old home."
"Golly, how mean," Phoebe said.
Miss Gumble nodded.
"So I had no choice. With no money and nowhere to go, I had to leave university and get a job teaching other people's children because that gave me a roof over my head."
"Why didn't you get married?" Phoebe said. "You must have been quite pretty once."
"I think you mean that as a compliment." Miss Gumble gave a sad smile. "There was a young man, but he died in the trenches in the Great War, like so many others. A whole generation of young men wiped out, Phoebe. For women of my age, there were no men to marry."
"Golly," Phoebe said again. "Do you think that will happen this time? Do you think by the end of this war there will be no men left for me to marry?"
"I hope not, for your sake," Miss Gumble said. "At least when the last war ended, we were still free, and we won, however terrible the cost."
Chapter 19 All Saints Vicarage. Over at the vicarage, Reverend Cresswell opened the Morning Post and looked surprised.
"Well, well," he said. "We've received an invitation to a dinner party tomorrow night at the Prescotts. That's a turn-up for the books, isn't it, Ben?"
"At the Prescotts?" Ben paused.
"I suppose they've only invited us as a courtesy."
"Nonsense, my boy," the vicar said. "They've invited you as Jeremy's oldest friend. I'm the courtesy."
"We don't have to go," Ben said.
"Not go? I personally shall look forward to a slap-up meal in these times of economy. One hears things about the Prescott's table."
Ben wished he could come up with a good reason not to go.
Lord Westram's family would most definitely be invited, and he'd have to watch Jeremy and Pamela gazing at each other with that special look.
"Get used to it," he muttered to himself, disgusted with his own weakness. He was here to work, and the dinner party would see the leading lights in the local community assembled in one place, a perfect opportunity for observation.
"Then we can't deprive you of a good meal," Ben got up. "I'll write an RSVP note to Lady Prescott."
After breakfast, he took out the bicycle. It was a brisk, windy day with the promise of rain. He went back inside again to look for his wind cheater.
"I'm going for a bike ride," he said to his father.
The vicar looked at him critically.
Don't take this fitness thing too far, Benjamin. You've nothing to prove. You've made a remarkable recovery from your accident.
Ben swallowed back annoyance.
I'd hardly call peddling around the village taking fitness too far. I thought I'd go by the old Oast House and see if the artists who live there now will let me see their work.
Good luck,
the vicar smiled. From what I've heard, I wouldn't say putting out the welcome mat was one of their virtues. In fact, they threatened to shoot someone who was using the public footpath. We had to get the local bobby to talk to them and explain about rights of way.
Then it might prove to be an interesting encounter, Ben said, and headed for the front door.
Half a mile out of the village, he rather regretted his bravado. The wind was coming up from the Thames estuary, hitting him full in the side and threatening to topple him around each bend. It was fine when the lane dipped between high hedges, but when it skirted the open barley field, it was brutal. Still, he was not about to get off and walk. He went first to Broadbent's farm. Old Mr. Broadbent was mucking out a pigsty when Ben cycled up, with a yapping dog on either side of him.
"Well, if it isn't young Ben," he said, wiping down his hands as he came toward the bike.
He invited Ben in for a cup of tea, and they talked about the shortage of farm workers and how the land girls had taken over from the young men.
"Good hard workers, some of them," Mr. Broadbent said. "Others are hopeless, worry more about their hair and make-up than getting the job done. I've got a couple going behind the haystack for a smoke. The haystack, mind you. I told them if that went up, my beasts would have no fodder for the winter, and we'd all starve."
He shook his head.
"Don't have much of a clue, city girls."
Ben hadn't considered that the contact for the fallen parachutist might be a woman.
"Any of them foreign?" he asked.
"There's Trudy from Austria. She's one of my good hard workers. Comes from a farm at home. I put her in charge of the hopeless ones, and she keeps them on their toes."
Ben brought the fallen man into the conversation, but the farmer had only vaguely heard of him and didn't seem interested.
"I suppose you're bound to get some accidents in wars, aren't you?" he said, and offered Ben a slice of pork pie.
On his way out, Ben stopped to chat with some of the girls and learned that Trudy was not well-liked. She made the girls work too hard, and what's more, she was dating one of the soldiers stationed at Farley. A good-looking bloke, too. She slipped out at night to see him. They seemed delighted to tattle on her. Ben rode off again, his stomach full, and only an Austrian named Trudy to add to his list. Trudy, who was conveniently dating one of the soldiers. He went on to the infamous Oast House, wondering how he could approach the two hostile owners who had shot at trespassers. They were both artists, he knew that much. It would be time to channel Guy Harcourt, who roomed next door to him. Guy was very keen on modern art and design, and had tried, unsuccessfully, to convert Ben to his tastes. But today his small amount of knowledge might come in useful. The Oast House still lay between two rows of hops, but there was now a picket fence and a gate separating the hop fields from a front garden full of roses. A rose bower curved over the front door. Ben had to admit that it created a lovely picture of rural serenity, except for the sign on the gate saying, "Keep out, no soliciting." Ben opened the gate cautiously and wheeled his bike up to the front door. There was a brass knocker with what looked like a demon's face on it. Ben hesitated before he knocked. The door was opened by a chubby man dressed all in black, a black fisherman's jersey in spite of the warm weather and baggy black trousers. He had a podgy face, a stack of straw-coloured hair, and a black cigarette hanging from one corner of his mouth. Ben took in the smell of foreign tobacco.
"Well, what do you want? If you think we're donating to any metal or paper drive, you can think again."
He had a slight foreign accent that Ben could not identify.
"Actually, I'm the vicar's son," Ben said, but the man cut him off.
"And you're not getting us to church, either. We don't believe in that nonsense."
"I'm not here to convert, either," Ben said. "Someone said you were artists, and I'm an admirer of modern art myself, so I wondered..."
"You're an aficionado yourself? Whose work do you admire?"
Ben racked his brains for artists that Guy had talked about. He had dragged him to galleries when there were still such things.
"Well, I admire Carl Schmidt Rutloff and, of course, Paul Klee, although it's probably not permitted to admire a German artist any more."
"Then you'd better come in," the man said. "Sergei's work has been compared to Schmidt Rutloff's," he went ahead of Ben. "Oh, Sergei, come out wherever you are. We have a civilized visitor at last," he called in fluted tones.
Another man came out of a back room. He was tall, dark, and lean, with sharp features, and was wearing a paint-spattered smock.
"Sergei, this young man is an admirer of Schmidt Rottluff's. I told him your work has been compared to his."
"Really?"
He was looking at Ben skeptically.
"You admire the German expressionists?"
"Oh, definitely," Ben said, hoping the discussion did not get too deep. He looked around the room.
On the walls were several awful paintings, bright daubs of primary colours and distorted figures. Ben thought that Guy might actually like them. Ben said,
"Your work, Sergei?"
The dark man nodded.
"You approve?"
"Powerful."
The man nodded again.
"You are most kind."
Ben's gaze lingered on an elongated purple woman. He was sure that he'd seen the picture before. Hadn't Guy pinned up a postcard of it?
"Have you exhibited much in galleries?" he asked.
"A little," Sergei shrugged.
"You are from Russia?"
Ben asked. The accent was still strong.
"I am. I came here when I was no longer allowed to paint anything other than healthy peasant women operating harvesting machines. There is no art in Russia any more."
"Did you also come here when you could no longer practice your art?" Ben asked the other man.
He smiled.
"I am from Denmark, my dear, where usually anything goes. But I got out in a hurry when the Germans were about to invade, and thank my lucky stars that I did so. I would not have made a good Nazi. I don't salute well, for one thing, and I'm hopeless at taking orders," he grinned. "You are the first halfway civilized person we've met since we moved here. Most of them are Philistines, aren't they, Sergei?"
Sergei nodded.
"Philistines."
He frowned at Ben.
"So what are you doing in these parts?"
"My father is the local vicar. I'm here on a few days' leave."
"A soldier? A sailor?"
"Civilian, I'm afraid. I was in a plane crash."
"Don't apologize. Be grateful that you're not part of the carnage." "We are certainly grateful that they are not yet calling up men over 40, aren't we, Hansi?"
The chubby man nodded.
"Would you like to try our homemade parsnip wine? It packs quite a kick, I'll warn you."
Ben nodded and was handed a glass. Ben took a sip, gasped as the liquid burned his throat, then asked,
"So did you come here from London?"
They both nodded.
"We lived in Chelsea, naturally," the chubby Hansi said. "Then a house 3 doors away was bombed, and we said that's too close for comfort and fled here. We were taken with the building immediately. It has character, don't you think?"
"Definitely," Ben said, "although I still remember when the hops were hung to dry in the tower."
"Are you also a painter?"
"Sculptor," Hansi said.
"I work with metal. Or rather, I worked with metal when there was any. I used to make great outdoor pieces. Now, of course, every piece of scrap metal goes toward building another bomb or plane, so I am reluctantly switching to clay, of which there is no shortage."
Ben looked from one to the other. The saturnine Sergei from Russia. Ben could picture him working with the Nazis. But the affable Hansi, and yet he worked with metal. He would have any tools that a visiting German paratrooper would need. When he left them, half an hour later, they parted on the friendliest of terms with an open invitation for Ben to visit them whenever he was back in the area. He rode away, wobbling a little along the path, as the wind had become even stronger, and he was feeling the effects of the potent parsnip wine. As he cycled wearily home, he realized that he was none the wiser. Two artists seemed to have fled to England to escape from tyranny and only wanted peace and quiet to create their art. And yet they had chosen a remote location, and Hansi wouldn't be the first German to claim he was Danish. The local farmers were solid local men he had known all his life. Their land girls beyond reproach, except for an Austrian called Trudy who was dating a soldier. But the dead man had landed in Lord Westerham's field, presumably for a good reason. Ben hoped the dinner party might give him some sort of clue.
Chapter 20. At Nethercote, the dinner party. Ben was glad for long summer evenings as he and his father walked up the drive to Nethercote, the Prescott's residence. He was also glad the driveway was straight. It wouldn't be so easy to walk back in the dark with just a flashlight covered in black cloth to guide their steps. No light was permitted to shine out from the windows of any house, and the whole way home would be in total darkness. Ben tried to remember if there would be a moon. He turned to ask his father. "In its third quarter, so it won't be any use to us, unless we stay very late, which we won't," Reverend Cresswell said. "I have to admit, I am looking forward to the food, but I'm beginning to find the prospect of the evening a little daunting. Still, if it's just us and the Sutton family, then it won't be too bad, will it? Just like old times." Ben nodded. "Just like old times," he thought. They pushed open the tall, wrought-iron gates that hadn't yet been commandeered for scrap metal, and their feet crunched over the raked gravel as they walked up the path. He was marvelling at the beautifully kept state of the grounds when his father said, "I see they haven't tried to convert their lawns to potato patches. The place looks positively sinful. They must still have gardeners." "They do," Ben said. "I saw them working when I came here with Pamela the other day."
"You came here with Pamela?"
Ben nodded. "She was worried about seeing Jeremy by herself. I think she was frightened he'd be disfigured or something, but he seemed his old self, apart from having lost a lot of weight and being rather pale."
"That young man must have been a cat in a previous existence,"
his father said.
"He's certainly used most of 9 lives."
Ben nodded again. "And no doubt he'll be back tempting fate in a fighter plane again as soon as they'll let him."
"No doubt," Ben agreed.
They had just reached the front door when there was the sound of a motor engine behind them, and Lord Westerham's ancient Rolls-Royce came up the driveway. Lord Westerham himself, not a chauffeur, got out of the driver's seat and went around to open the passenger doors. His wife and daughters emerged one by one, smoothing out crumpled evening dresses. Ben watched Pamela step down daintily. She was wearing a pale blue Grecian gown, the perfect shade for her ash-blonde hair and English complexion.
"Good evening, Vicar. How very nice to see you, Ben,"
Lady Esme called.
"Lovely evening, isn't it? The weather has been so perfect lately, almost as if it's mocking us, don't you think?"
Ben's father gave a nodding bow.
"Good evening, Lady Westerham. Yes, we are having a spell of glorious weather, so essential for the crops. Too bad we had a full motor car, or we could have given you a lift," Lord Westerham said.
"At the speed you drive, they could have walked here faster, Pa,"
Dido retorted as she emerged last from the rolls in pale pink, making her look young and vulnerable. Ben realized that none of the girls would have had new dresses since the war had started and clothing was rationed. Diana's was probably a hand-me-down from Pamela's season. Pamela gave Ben a big smile as the girls followed their parents up the front steps. Ben and his father fell into line behind them after the door was opened by a maid. Then they were ushered through to an elegant drawing room. Ben noticed that there were already several people in the room at the same time as Lord Westerham muttered to his wife, "I thought you said it was a small dinner party. This is a bloody great bean feast. I wish we'd never come." Lady Westerham took his arm and dragged him firmly forward so that he had no chance to escape before Sir William and Lady Prescott came forward to greet them. Lady Prescott was in gold lamé, Sir William immaculate in tails.
"How good of you to come!" She held out her hands to Lady Esme. "It was good of you to invite us,"
Lady Esme allowed the other to hold her hands.
"I can't tell you how long it's been since we've been invited out for a meal. I feel as if I'm escaping from the cage."
"We simply had to celebrate Jeremy's escape and safe arrival, didn't we? I still think it's an absolute miracle."
She extended an arm to the other occupants of the room.
"I'm sure you've met everybody," she said. "Obviously, you know Colonel and Mrs. Huntley and Miss Hamilton, and I'm sure you must be well acquainted with Colonel Pritchard, since he now lives under your roof."
"Of course."
There were polite noddings and how-do-you-dos from the newcomers to those mentioned.
"But are you already acquainted with Lord and Lady Musgrove? Lord Musgrove has just inherited Highcroft Hall."
Ben took in the young, stylishly dressed couple. He tried to place Highcroft Hall.
"Is that so?"
Lord Westerham turned to his wife for confirmation.
"We heard old Lord Musgrove had died some time ago, didn't we, Esme?"
"We did. We're so glad the place is to be occupied again."
The young man gave a glance at his wife before he smiled and held out his hand to Lord Westerham.
"How do you do? Frederick Musgrove and my wife, Cecile. We were living in Canada, so it took some time to track us down. I can tell you it was quite a shock when a solicitor's letter arrived telling me I'd inherited Highcroft and the title. Obviously knocked me off my feet. As a son of a younger son, I never expected to inherit anything, which is why I went to Canada. But the Great War killed off the other heirs, so here I am."
He gave a boyish grin.
"I've been earning my living by the sweat of my brow like everyone else."
"Hardly the sweat of your brow, Freddy," his wife said.
She grinned and looked across at the company.
"He's been working in a bank in Toronto."
"A bank? Really? How fascinating,"
Lord Westerham said, and received a dig in the side from his wife.
"So let me complete the introductions," Lady Prescott went on. "These are our neighbours, Lord and Lady Westerham, and their daughters, Olivia, Pamela, and Diana. And this is our beloved local rector, Reverend Cresswell, and his son, Ben. Ben has been our son's dearest friend since they could toddle. And speaking of our son, where can he have got to?"
She looked up, and a beaming smile spread across her face.
"Ah, here he is, the miracle man himself."
There was a round of applause. Jeremy, looking even thinner and paler against the black of a dinner jacket, stood in the doorway and gave a sheepish grin as his mother rushed over to grab his arm and drag him toward the assembled guests.
"Isn't he wonderful?" Lady Prescott said. "I can't tell you what it means to have him back with us, against all odds."
"Mother, please." Jeremy gave an embarrassed smile.
"Dashed brave of you, young fellow," Colonel Huntley said. "Took a lot of guts to do what you did. Just shows that we British have stronger fibre than the Hun. You can't see a German doing what you did. They'd be waiting to obey orders."
"Not quite true, Colonel," Jeremy said. "There are some terribly terrific German fighter pilots. It's a privilege to engage in combat with them."
"Enough talk of war," Sir William interrupted. "Let's get down to more practical matters. What are we all drinking? Scotch for you, old chap?" he asked Lord Westerham. "Do you care for a single malt?"
"I wouldn't say no," Lord Westerham said.
"Damned good of you, Prescott. I haven't had a decent whisky in ages."
Sir William snapped a finger to a footman standing at a drinks table.
"And you lovely ladies, a cocktail, maybe? Or would you prefer a sherry?"
"Oh, I don't think I know much about cocktails," Lady Esme said, looking rather pink. "Perhaps I'd better stick to a sherry."
"Well, I'd like a sidecar if you're offering," Dido said. "Wouldn't you, Pamela?"
Pamela hesitated, feeling Jeremy's eyes on her. Then she said,
"Why not? That would be lovely."
As the footman served drinks, Jeremy came over to Pamela, who was now standing with Ben.
"I see you're up and walking," she said.
"Yes, doing rather well, actually," he said. "I'm hoping the quack will certify me ready to go back to work."
"Surely not."
Pamela shot Ben an alarmed look.
"Well, they won't let me fly for a while, but at least I can be useful in a desk job like old Ben here. They've told me they can use me at the Air Ministry, and Father says I can stay at the London flat."
"You still have a flat in London?" Ben asked.
"Yes, my father keeps a place just off Curzon Street. He used to stay up there during the week when he was working in the city more than he does now. Jolly convenient. You must all come and visit me."
He looked from Ben to Dido, but his gaze lingered with Pamela.
"I know. When I'm settled in, we'll have a party. How about that?"
"A party in London?"
Dido's face was alight with excitement.
"Don't get your hopes up," Pamela said in a low voice. "I'm sure Pa wouldn't let you go."
"But if I say that you and Ben will chaperone me, then Pa can't object, can he?"
"There won't be any trains back home late at night," Pamela said.
"You can all stay the night at my place. We'll make an all-nighter of it and finish up with bacon and eggs, just like the parties in the old days during the season," Jeremy said. "Everyone's invited. You too, Livy."
Livy had been standing silently at the back of the group. She shook her head.
"Oh, thank you, but no, it wouldn't be right with my husband away serving his country."
Jeremy laughed.
"Didn't I hear that he landed a plum assignment guarding the Duke of Windsor in the Bahamas?"
"Jolly dangerous job protecting a member of the royal family," Livy said hotly. "You know very well that the Germans would love to kidnap him and put him in the place of the king."
"Your husband is with the Duke of Windsor?" Lord Musgrove asked, coming over to join the group.
Livy nodded.
"Actually, Teddy was upset when he was removed from his regiment before they went off to Africa, but the Duke asked for him particularly. They were old polo teammates, you know."
"I must say, I feel that the poor old Duke of Windsor has been rather shabbily treated."
Lord Musgrove took a swig of his whisky.
"Packed off into exile like Napoleon."
"For his own safety," Livy said.
"To keep him well away from interfering in what's going on in Europe," Sir William said. "His wife has shown a great fondness for Hitler, after all." "I still think it's a shame," Lord Musgrove said. "I've always thought he was a decent fellow. He might well have proved a useful intermediary if we ever needed to negotiate a settlement with Germany." "Settle with Germany?"
Lord Westerham turned to glare at Musgrove.
"Over my dead body?"
"Quite possibly," Lord Musgrove smiled. The strong liquor stung as Pamela swallowed it. She wasn't used to drinking anything stronger than beer and cider, and before the war, the odd glass of wine. But she wasn't going to be outshone by Dido, who seemed quite at ease with cocktails. As Pamela's mother hastily led the discussion to safer waters, Jeremy moved closer to her.
"You will come to my party, won't you?" he whispered.
"I don't know if I'll be able to get time off," she said warily.
"You don't have to work in the evenings, do you?"
"I'm on night shifts at the moment, actually."
"Night shifts? What on earth are you doing? Fire watching?"
"No," Pamela gave a nervous little chuckle. "But they need support staff around the clock."
"Which ministry did you say it was?"
"I didn't," she said. "But we do a bit of work for each of the services. Fact-checking, looking up things."
"Jolly good for you."
He rested his hand on her arm. Then he said, in a quiet voice,
"This party's all for you, you know. I want you to come and see the flat."
His grip on her tightened, and he led her off to one side.
"Look, I'm sorry we started off on the wrong foot. That was thoughtless and crass of me. I suppose I was so eager. Well, you can understand, can't you? All those months of dreaming about you, fantasizing. I got a little carried away, I'm afraid. So can we pretend that never happened and start over? Take it slowly. Get to know each other again."
He was looking earnestly into her eyes.
"All right," she said.
"Jolly good."
His eyes still held hers.
Chapter 21. Still at Nethercote. The gong sounded, and they lined up to go into dinner. Ben was assigned to escort Dido at the back of the line. His father was asked to escort the elderly spinster, Miss Hamilton. Naturally, Jeremy and Pamela were paired together. Ben watched the back of her head and saw her laugh as Jeremy whispered something funny to her.
"We're clearly the runts of the litter back here," Dido muttered to Ben as they started to process into the dining room. Inside, chandeliers sparkled over a long, polished table. A maid and a footman stood in attendance, ready to pull out chairs. Ben found himself between Colonel Huntley's wife and the commander of the Royal West Kents, whom he hadn't met before. Jeremy and Pamela sat across from him. Lady Prescott was at the foot of the table with the two lords, Westerham and Musgrove, on either side of her. Her gown and the diamonds at her throat sparkled in the light of the chandeliers, and she looked around the gathering with satisfaction.
"We should have a toast before we start eating, William," she said. "Celebrating our son's return when we thought we'd lost him, and he made it home."
Her voice wavered suddenly, and she put her napkin up to her mouth to stifle the sob.
"Steady on, old thing," Sir William said. "Jeremy's home, and that's certainly worth celebrating. We'll drink a toast to him and our good friends, and the fact that even in the bleakest of times we can get together and still enjoy ourselves."
"Hear, hear,"
the murmur echoed around the room. Champagne corks were popped and glasses were poured.
"Where on earth did you manage to find champagne?" Lady Esme asked.
"Ah, well, that was a stroke of luck," Sir William laughed. "Little wine shop I know near Covent Garden. A bomb fell next door, and the owner panicked. I told him I'd buy the place from him, including all his stock. He was only too glad to accept my offer and flee, and I ended up with some damned fine wines, enough to last me through the war."
"If it's over in the foreseeable future," Miss Hamilton said in her clipped tones.
"It has to be," Sir William said. "We can't go on like this. If America doesn't come in, we're done for. We can't hold off the invasion forever by ourselves."
"America shows no signs of hearing the call," Colonel Huntley sniffed derisively. "Only interested in lending us some equipment at exorbitant rates, making a profit out of our misery."
"Well, we definitely need the equipment. It has to come from somewhere," the Colonel of the West Kent said. "We can't fight without it. Do you know, when my men were first called up, they had to drill with sticks of wood instead of rifles? That's how bad things have been. And we're losing Spitfires at an alarming rate."
"Sometimes I think it would be more sensible to make a pact with Mr. Hitler," Lady Musgrove said. I fear it will go on and on until we're on our knees and starving, and then Hitler will walk in anyway, and what will we have achieved?
It's that warmonger Churchill, her husband agreed. The power has gone to his head. I think he's actually enjoying this.
Absolutely bloody poppycock, Lord Westrum thundered. If it weren't for Churchill, we'd all be slaves of Germany.
Not slaves, surely. One Aryan race to another. Equals, Lord Musgrove said.
Ask the Danes and Norwegians how well that is working, Colonel Pritchard said.
There was an uncomfortable silence.
Let's not talk of such gloomy things tonight, Lady Prescott begged. We're celebrating, remember? And if our son managed to escape from their beastly prison camp and came all the way across Europe to be with us, then surely that's a sign that they are not invincible. If we are brave and stand up to them, then they can't win.
Well said, Lady Prescott.
Colonel Huntley nodded approvingly.
That's the ticket. A fighting spirit. Britons never, never, never shall be slaves.
Is that a cue for someone to break into song? Jeremy asked with an amused look on his face.
They'll always be in England. Rule Britannia.
He winked at Pamela.
It's a sign that we get down to some serious eating, his father said.
He nodded at the servants, and soup tureens were carried around.
Is this oyster stew? Lord Westrum asked in amazement. Where the devil did you manage to get oysters?
Sir William smiled.
Usually they are found in the sea.
Actually, I have a little man in Whitstable. He couldn't get me enough for a dozen each, but there was enough to make a good oyster stew.
But the coastline is off limits to civilians.
Sir William was still smiling.
Who said anything about being a civilian? Sorry, Colonel, or rather Colonels, but rules are made to be bent in times of need, and those oysters would die without being harvested. Such a shame.
He tucked into his bowl with relish. The others followed. Bowls were whisked away to be replaced with grilled trout. Again, Sir William smiled.
And before you ask, I stocked the lake. They are all homegrown.
After the trout, there came roast pork, thin pink slices topped with crackling, and a mound of sage and onion stuffing.
Don't tell me you have your own pigs, too, Colonel Huntley said.
Actually, no. This leg of pork came from a chap who knows a chap. You can pretty much get anything, if you know where to look and are prepared to pay.
Black market, you mean?
Lord Westrum looked as if he were about to explode again.
You don't have to eat it, old chap, Sir William said. In fact, it was quite legitimate. A bomb fell on a pigsty. The pigs were either killed or wounded and had to be put down anyway.
At least that's his story and he's sticking to it, Lord Musgrove said and got a general laugh. The pork was accompanied by crispy roast potatoes and asparagus.
From our vegetable garden, Lady Prescott said proudly. We've had a good crop this year.
Glasses of claret were poured. Ben ate as if in a dream. After the austerity of the digs he shared with Guy and the bleakness of life in London, it was almost too much for the senses to bear, to be sitting at a glittering table, eating course after course of delicious food, drinking fine wine, looking at Pamela sitting across the table from him. He expected an air raid siren to wake him up.
"So do you have Highcroft Hall all to yourselves, Lord Musgrove, or has someone been billeted to you?"
Lady Esme asked.
"So far it's just us, but then the place is in bad shape and needs lots of work done. We only have a few rooms that are fit to live in. But the fearsome old biddy in charge of requisitions did hint that we'd have to take our share of evacuees if and when they were sent from London."
We have one at Farley, Lady Westrum said. Be honest, Ma, you palmed him off to the gamekeeper, Livy said.
Much kinder, Lady Esme said.
One could tell the poor little chap was terrified in a place the size of Farley, and I know he's well fed with the gamekeeper.
"Wasn't he the one who found that body in your field?" Ben asked innocently, seizing the chance to bring up the subject and to observe their reaction.